it's fallible to think that chefs don't make mistakes. Like, I've burnt omelets, I've overcooked things, I've undercooked things. Hug your mom, hug your dad, break bread. If you're pissed off or upset with your parents, stop it, end it and give them a hug. If we took them to the dinner table on Sunday, in this world would probably be less problems if you just kind of talked about it, negotiated through it, communicated with it. It always goes back to what's on the table.
Welcome back to another episode of the Chats with Clark podcast. I'm your host, Joe Clark, and here at Chats with Clark, we don't do poppy intros. We get straight to the point. And the point of today's episode, episode 79, is Rocco Whalen, the renowned Cleveland-based chef who trained under the famous Wolfgang Puck and is known for his Fahrenheit restaurant where we are now in this beautiful ambiance. Someone who continues to excel in the space with awards upon awards to his name, Rocco Whalen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being
here. Excited to be here. Not on these often, so it's nice to sit down and break bread at the table and talk about, the next fun little while of content.
Absolutely. I'm excited to hear it. You're such a staple in the Cleveland community. And to dive right into it with you, Rocco, what would you say is the best thing that there is to know about you?
I'm a homer. I love my towns. I love Cleveland. It's my hometown. I love Charlotte. It's my second hometown. Obviously, but I'm a homer. I'm crushing beers at Browns games. I'm watching double plays at Guardians games. I'm watching the Cavs do their thing at Rocket Mortgage, One Center Court. I love the arts. I love the Rock Hall. I love the museums. I love the people, the culture, the fabric we all share is being from Cleveland, and it's just a fantastic place to grow up where I'm from, Northeast Ohio. My wife and I are family, so that's one thing. I'm a homer.
It's such a powerful community, and I think we're blessed with all of those resources that you just mentioned, all rooted in these people that love each other and support each other.
True.
How did you recognize that you started to really appreciate this community?
When I was a graduate in my youth of Mentor High School, I moved to Pittsburgh to go to culinary school. And then I dove in on a externship on the West Coast, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and got some really, really, obviously, Wolfgang Puck, Hilton Hotels, some really great experience for 4 or 5 years. And then I kind of understood like what it was to be away from home and, certain aspects of Northeast Ohio kind of called me back home. My mother got ill, and there's no place like home, but also it's like there's something to say for how you were raised, the morals of the region you were raised in. My entire family is in Northeast Ohio, Lake County, Cuyahoga County. And my brother's a paramedic firefighter. My other brother-in-law is in construction. My nephews one's a lawyer. The other one is a project manager for a construction company. Another brother-in-law is in IT. My nephew works for, the laborers union and is working on the Rock Hall right now, is in the steel realm. I have the menus at the Rock Hall. So home is where my heart always was. I'm glad that I did and made the adjustments I made and did go out and see what the other parts of the country at Phoenix at the time, Los Angeles in its heyday, late 90s after OJ, prior to, 03, 02, when I opened, I had this just knowledge at Las Vegas. Think about Las Vegas before 9/11. I came back home because, 9/11 happened and Las Vegas kind of turned into 7,000 flights a day to 700 flights a day. And unless you had really great large seniority at some of these companies, Caesar's Palace was dropping 25% of their staff. So it was like it was a butcher shop in the sense of bloodbath. Came home, found a little bistro on the near west side in a neighborhood I had knew nothing about called Tremont. I mean, at the time it was Michael Simon's Lola. It was Sokolowski's. It was, High and Dry, the old High and Dry, the real High and Dry. I think there's another one now named that, but it's just, I think, in naming. So it was the shady South Side. So I opened Fahrenheit in 02, 20, just turned 24. Made a ton of people eat crow. Along the way, you've got Michael Simon and then Rocco Whalen and then Michael Hirschman and then Zach Burrell and then Dante Boccuzzi and then, you know, Sokolowski's and Heather Haviland and Lucky's Cafe, and then you get Sonny Ting at Typhoon, and then you get, you know, Justin next door to me at the Creole place at the time. You get a collection of great restaurants where you could start, okay, park at Fahrenheit and then drop your keys, walk to the Treehouse for a Guinness, walk to Lola for knuckle sandwiches from, at the time, the only Food and Wine best new chef in Cleveland at the time, Michael Simon, dear friend of me, at Lola. So I could walk out Fahrenheit and look two blocks and see Lola. And between me and Lola was, you know, the church, you know, bunch of churches, bunch of Elliot Ness, old school neighboring neighborhood stories of things. Tremont gave me that, just the empty blank canvas, all these great chefs, the real estate was priced right. And I believe at the time, I don't think there was a better strip of real estate in Cleveland's culinary history. I'm talking Chef Boyardee, Carl Quagliotta, Giovanni's. I don't think there was a better strip of restaurants than Professor Avenue from 2006 to 2015. And then I think Michael moved Lola to downtown, and then he opened Lolita, and, you know, things took shape in other parts of town. And that really blossomed into, you know, a couple of years ago, landlord in Tremont, there's a lot of older buildings, wasn't necessarily looking to upgrade the facilities. And I wasn't necessarily looking to continue to pour money into something that wasn't necessarily tangibly mine. So developer kind of talked to me about this, and we're right outside the Sherwin-Williams Tower where, you know, 3,100 people, great customers to me, sit across the way every day. This opportunity, though, offers lunch and dinner and different things where we're sitting right now, and kind of is a testament to me being a homer. I wasn't done yet, and I wanted to come downtown, and I believe my energy and the energy of the independent operators in the city matches downtown, nightlife. We've got a rooftop. Cosmopolitan, though, metropolitan, sexiness, and it's kind of what we have behind us, the view, the building, the space my wife designed. Lexi, she doesn't get enough credit, but she put this together, and whimsically, I get to run around every night and do Bananas Foster's tableside, or, you know, carve meats Wagyu, and, you know, do a beef dinner with Joe Thomas, or just kind of engage the people of Cleveland. So to answer your question, I think I got off task a little, but that's who and why and where we sit today.
Yeah, you know, Rocco, it's interesting. All these great names that you've mentioned just keep staying. And if that doesn't speak to what Cleveland has as a community, then I don't know what does. Or even, again, Joe Thomas, who grew a great affinity for our city, has stays and pours money and resources and time and his presence into the city.
I think so. And I'll jump on that too. From 95 to 99, the Browns left, and that's okay. It's a scar to every Clevelander, and, you know, it's salt in the wound. So then, you know, and let's say LeBron 03, and I'm going to date myself a little here, but several years of playoff opportunities, but we never got over that hump with LeBron in that first session. And then he left, and Cleveland culinary never left. And like the scene was always thriving in the sense of the Browns left. We still had dinner places to go and you could get reservations. LeBron came in 03 and started playing great basketball. And that just continued to put fuel on that fire that was the Cleveland culinary scene. And then you get not just Tremont and Ohio City and Detroit Shoreway, it's East 4th and West 6th and Public Square. You know, whether it's my restaurant or the Blue Point Grill that's been there for 30 years now, it's like established seafood powerhouse. Why not embrace those places with a big hug and enjoy that Johnny's on a Friday night in the summer pulls up a flatbed with a band on it, or there's fresh piano playing with frog legs and crab cakes and the things that Johnny's does well. I've always been that play nice in the sandbox chef, and I've always been taught that way too in Tremont. Prior to coming downtown and being a Clevelander, we all are in this boat together. We never get enough credit. We're always the mistake on the lake. We're always going to have the burning river in the 60s that caught on fire because of the trash and all that malarkey that people like to talk about outside of the city corridors. We don't really hear that. It's like I go soft to that in the ear because I love Cleveland so much, and I just love having the opportunity to serve people and be a hospitable host.
For you to be in the same strip as Michael Simon, who you mentioned is a great friend, and to not come into quarrels or have your qualms with each other, but rather to be good friends, I think is another great testament to those values that you talked about previously of Cleveland. It is very support each other, lift each other up type. Why have you found that that's so innate here as opposed to maybe...
It's a little harder to do it here than in other cities. I think there's not as much critical mass. There's not as much compression of people. We just got over that 20,000 people living downtown hurdle. You know, there's 87,000 people in downtown Boston and 113,000 people in downtown Philadelphia. You know, and it's just structurally, it's a mid-market city. But chefs, sports teams, people, you know, the things that the community, the banking, everybody has each other's backs. And like we all kind of thrive together and strive together. Without me, maybe, or Sherwin, the next operator won't come downtown or revive their brand or want to be part of what's going on or pick up a piece of a parcel of real estate. Or, you know, there's different communities for everybody. But I think that helping each other out has always been something that's kind of driven me in Northeast Ohio, but also something that just retains talent. Like people talk about, they go to Case, or they go to John Carroll, and then they split. That's not the story in the Case as much anymore, because Cleveland Clinic comes strong with 100,000 employees, and there's jobs and AI, and there's opportunities with medicine is always going to be a strength in this town. Culinary, I think, is always going to be a strength in this town. Having the community of theater that we have, like the orchestra. Yes. Have you ever been to the orchestra for the Christmas, in December? It's
incredible.
Nuts.
Yeah.
Top five in the world. Top five. They're conductors from, they come in for residency for a few years at a time just to get it on their resume to be built. That's community. That's what, and it's, and then you just lace between that the Christmas Story House and Ralphie and, and the leg lamp and the fact that we are a four season city. People, the community, we're a four seasons community when it comes to that too. And Cleveland will always have each other's backs, even on our worst days. Years ago, when police cars started getting flipped and on fire and people were starting to tarnish storefronts, we came together as a community. There's no doubt about it, quickly. And we made sense of it all. That's what Clevelanders do. The common sense factor with Cleveland and Northeast Ohio will always be there. And you always want to have the backs of your community.
Totally agree with that.
And chefs are part of that. You know, like when I opened Tremont, it was Michael and I basically, and you know, there was payphone elements and, you know, activities that go on in payphones. We won't mention what those activities are, but we started like lifting up the community and kind of reviving the community and get rid of those payphones and, you know, swept our corners. Mm-hmm. And at that point, like you got these two really public prolific chefs that are cleaning up the city or cleaning up a section of their town, or the neighborhood's a little more vibrant, or people feel a little bit safer. They don't clutch their purses as tight anymore because Rocco's on this corner and Michael Simon's on that corner. And we're driving in business and we're driving in people and we're driving in safety because you have all these nice cars now. It's a trickle down effect. So I've watched an evolution of a neighborhood and cities, and I have the unique factor of watching it in a couple cities, being Charlotte. You know, I've been there now for 14 years and, I was the first rooftop restaurant that opened in Charlotte, open air rooftop restaurant in Charlotte 14 years ago. So
congrats. Amazing.
Thank you. And I've got, it's nothing more or less than what my wife work and try to achieve for, but we've got a different optic for a lot of different things. So fun times and fun towns.
Taking it back a little bit. So you're finishing up high school. You're getting ready to head into your next phase of life.
Yeah.
How did you land on culinary school and knowing that that would be your path?
Real easy. Letterman football player, Menor High.
Great football program.
There's two things I did. I did show choir, which got me a little bit of a stage presence and got me in front of people and got those. I shook those nerves out early. So when I do Fox 8 or Kenny Crumpton or Wayne Dawson or whatever, I'm ready. I was the only football player in home ec. 15 girls in my class plus me. And man, I could make this ripping cupcake. They were all in awe. I didn't like bookwork. I didn't like studies. I understood math, but some of the other classes, the teachers and I didn't get really, you know, hit it off and see eye to eye. And so I looked out the window a lot and I didn't get great grades, but I knew I wanted to go to culinary school. And this is before, you know, Emeril was starting to tell everybody on the Food Network that would listen that pork fat rules and, you know, Julia Child and Jacques Pepin and all these, you know, the Food Network was just starting to bubble. And grocery stores, the ethnicity quantities of grocery stores was very limited. You know, the Food Network kind of opened Pandora's box. Now you can find different types of nori and rice vinegar for sushi and pickled ginger. You can make sushi at home tonight. You couldn't do that 20 years ago to a grocery store. You could get canned raviolis. You could get mac and cheese. You could get, you know, we, our age type folk, grew up in a time where society was fast casual in their mindset and diet. And it kind of evolved back into organic and back into farm to table and back into shelf stable. We've watched the grocery store aisles just grow and pulse and pump. And so when my customers come in and they have a piece of Wagyu, you know, they relate to fine dining or friendly dining. They can get that at the store, but they couldn't 10 years ago. So just watching the community grow and the ingredients evolve, and, you know, there's like the Asian market, the night market, you know, did you see how many people go to that now and just want to have satays and pot stickers and dumplings and skewers and bao buns? And I've been around for a long time and I've watched these festivals grow, and I've had a food truck since 06 and I've watched these things for 20 years. So I'm a culture vulture. I love energy, and I love that, you know, anybody that says anything negative about Clayton has never really even been here.
So true.
Because I can take you through a gamut of fun things to do, and we're not going to go overload and have two lunches and two dinners, but we're going to go around town and show you that the fabric of the community is based on ethnicity, compassion, resources, West Side Market. Why do you think the West Side Market was so valuable to Rocco Whalen, Eric Williams, Michael Simon, Karen Small, and every other chef around town? Because on Saturdays, as we were in our, you know, in our youth, and we didn't have burgeoning restaurants, you know, it's like you got to make this limit on a delivery on a Saturday morning. You got to meet a minimum. Well, I couldn't meet a minimum. I didn't need $400 worth of strip steaks. I needed $40, but I could go to the West Side Market on a Saturday morning and get that product and work it through and be done. And, you know, Tremont Sunday closed. That was the community, and that's what the fabric of the community is. That's why the West Side Market is so valuable, celebrating its 120 whatever-th year. But it's like, I love that they're revamping it. I love that they're putting down the right refrigeration in the basement, and they're just putting in the resources that they finally need. So for me, it's all full circle, you know?
It's, you know, all, it's great too, right? Like everything at that market's pristine.
I want to do it all. I want some cheese from the cheese shop. I want some bread from Vera's. I want some fish from Kate's. I want a lobster roll on Saturday. They do a $22 lobster roll. They top it with caviar. It's delicious. That's what they're doing. Like, those are irreplaceable built-in hospitalities that you don't find in other cities. You don't. They try. They emulate in some ways, often replicated, never duplicated, I think is a very serious claim in a lot of cities. So Cleveland
can
say that.
That's a rockin' saying.
Yeah.
You spent time out west.
I did.
After school.
I did.
Training under one of the most influential, if not the most influential, chefs at the time.
Yes.
How did you go from just finishing up to being connected with Wolfgang Puck and studying under him?
So Wolfgang at the time, and, you know, it's changed a little because there was a Spago in Chicago. He wasn't a Midwest chef, but he was a West Coast chef, and they call him the father of California cuisine. And so when I graduated from my culinary school, working towards my externship from Pennsylvania Culinary, I landed in Phoenix. He was opening. I worked for a year at a Hilton, just got kind of like my feet wet and boots on the ground as far as I wanted to move originally to California, Los Angeles, right to the, you know, right to the head of the snake, Wolfgang, Spago, Beverly Hills, the whole nine yards. Wasn't open yet. It was still in West Hollywood at the time, but he opened a Pan Asian bistro called Aubergine. A lot of my food still, my short ribs with the noodles here, some of my Asian ingredients, the crispy rice, different things like that are some of the things that I was doing 30 years ago now. But he was just so far ahead of the envelope that his food then has sustained over time, where if you have like 4, 5, 6, 7 years of pedigree with him under your belt, you're pretty good in the sense of reputation based. He not only taught me how to absolutely just destroy and get every flavor out of every ingredient, remember customers' names, look them in the eye, go hit some tables, they want to know who you are. He was really that first chef that populated hitting the dining room, throwing a towel over your shoulder. How's your steak? Now's your chance to tell the chef at the table if it's prepared to your liking or not. That was him. And that was some of the life lessons, not just culinary. Take the absolute best ingredients on the planet that were coming to him, that were being sourced our way. Take that out of the equation. And you just talk about populating and being in a part of the dining room and learning the business side of that. Forget it. He's got a master's. He's the grandmaster. His son's doing it now. He's got 40 restaurants. He's grown at his pace. He's closed 40 restaurants and he still has 40 restaurants. He's done frozen lines. He's done soup lines. He's done none of that stuff really. Like, he's got 10, 12, 15 cookbooks. None of that stuff really hit with me as much as running restaurants and being an operator and learning, you know, people's names and shaking their hands. And, you know, if I'm in the room, people know it. And if he's in the room, people know it. So those are some of the best lessons I learned. Outside of that, his food is impeccable. His quality is impeccable. The bar he sets is super high. Like, it's stressful. For a few years with him, I didn't see a sunset. I was working every day, 7 days a week. No questions asked. I was young. I was hungry. I wasn't married. I did it for all the right reasons looking back now, because I can't think opportunities that arise now are based on some of that early days. But, and then kind of hard not to serve the best of the best in different markets too, like Los Angeles or Las Vegas or Phoenix. And I'll tell you a quick tidbit about Las Vegas. I'm running a pretty vital part of Caesar's Palace Spago. Take a number, throw it out, because they're doing quadruple that. It's Vegas pre 9/11. So the philosophy of that is you never know who's going to walk in. You never know who's playing with house's money. And everybody who's anybody is like, hey, I'm going to Vegas. Yeah. So it's like working there is a challenge, because every weekend you have friends that want to come to town and like blow their brains out with fun. And then you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I have to work. And it's like, over time, it wears on you. You can only stay there for short periods of time, or you're there a lifer. And I got in and out. I got great experience, dipped my toes into the Vegas market for a couple of years, but then I got out because it's not sustainable. It's hard to find a bar that doesn't have slot machines or video poker in their bar built in. It's hard to find a gas station that you can't gamble at while you're pumping. You hear ching, 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 ding, ding, ding. Cause back in those days, there was no paper slips. It was still the change coming out of the hopper. So you hear all that and it wears on you over time. But the experience, I'll never ever replace the Vegas time that I had. It'll be a chapter in my book if I ever do a memoir. But a fantastic chef, a fantastic operator to this day, see each other at an event, remembers me, says hello to me. Always very cordial, knows exactly what I did for him when I did it for him, the company. So great man, got nothing bad to say.
Yeah, it sounds like a whole picture type of person.
Yeah.
And I think that was maybe what challenged past chefs who stayed in the kitchen to now like, no, you need to create this Cleveland homey environment.
Almost. Yeah.
It's like he knew in a way your Midwestern Cleveland love, that homey feel, and was establishing that out west.
Kitchen windows, chef's kitchen, being able to look into the kitchen as they prepare your food. That was him. He wanted people to be a part of the moments, in the moments, feel the food, smell the food, embrace the food. That was him. Without him, you wouldn't have an open kitchen. It's encased in glass, because over time, open kitchens are great, but you don't want to hear a pan clank necessarily. But I learned a lot about him from a design aspect too, as well as just doing the right thing, being in front of people and making sure that they have a great time.
He's such a household name. Do you have a story, Rocco, that you could share that probably isn't out there for our audience? It gives you a little bit of insight to
for
who
LA,
is.
Like, you just kind of never know. I mean, so Caesar's Palace, the restaurant housed 6 walk-in coolers, one for lobsters, one for beef, one for caviar. Think about that. A tin or two of caviar in my kitchen tonight, $300 a tin. There was a cooler, a large size cooler full of caviar. That's how much at the time, you know, we're talking 99, 98, 97. We're talking, you know, if there was a peak of Vegas, it was probably the prior to 9/11 and then post 2008 housing market crash issues. But yeah, I mean, like, just the amount of opportunities put in front of you, the quality over quantity, the ingredients, the spec of ingredients, what everybody wanted and how Wolfgang wanted to treat that. Like, there's not really any like horror stories or anything. It was like just very filled with anxiety. You had to be in your game every day. Somebody was chomping at your bit, you know, and the amount of people that put pressure on, there were layers of it too. So, and to make everybody along the way, you learn a lot about that along the way, the pressure filled layers. So I wouldn't say there's any like bad stories. I would tell you there's nothing not out there, but great operator, great part of the world, great ingredients, great weather. You just learn a lot about it out there, you know, even if you're not catching sunsets.
I feel like we've all heard that phrase that pressure makes diamonds. So there are
diamonds,
so many
coal, one of the two.
True enough. I feel like both are very useful in their own respective.
One burns, the other one shines. You can get burnt out. You can shine like a diamond. You got to balance the two. And that's a lot of it too. It's like now I'm a little older. I don't work as vigorously as I used to, but the balance is very important to today's culinary world. He taught me a lot about that too, the balance side of it too. You can't just work 100 hours a week, 7 days a week. It doesn't work that way. Over time, it doesn't matter. You'll short circuit. Your body will implode. So it's important.
When you came back, Rocco, you ended up opening Fahrenheit at 24 years old, which is mind-blowing to think, given that we're sitting in Fahrenheit now. So clearly it worked.
Yeah.
But at 24 years old, you had the confidence to go all in on yourself.
Yeah.
What inspired that confidence, and how did you know that you'd be able to be successful with it?
So I was back from L.A., I was working at a restaurant, no names, just kind of getting them going. They were opening and they were expanding. A restaurant by the name of 88 Keys, two blocks from Lola at the time. And I'll reference that just because it's, you know, part of Tremont. On Professor Avenue, though, the flowers were still on the table. They were dying. It was closed for 6 days. It was a supper club called 88 Keys, and it had all the walls were painted the same color, maroon. And it had a piano in the corner, a grand piano. It was a piano bar, and man, it didn't work at all. And it was open for a few months. I rolled up pretty hot, struck a deal with the owner of the building at the time. I started the business. I gave the owner $50,000, and I opened with all his stuff, the glassware, the silverware, the flatware. I kind of robbed Peter to pay Paul, stocked the shelves with a bunch of wine, bunch of booze. So one of the things that, like, Cleveland and having some longevity in relation to other states is you can buy bourbon. So I've been buying bourbon for 30 years, and I have the biggest bourbon selection, I think, in Cleveland, based on I've been supporting it for so long. But back in the day, Tremont, couple restaurants, Cleveland was thirsty. They drank a lot of vodka. They drank a lot of gin. They drank a lot of Great Lakes. They drank a lot of bourbon. And we were ready, and we were there. And so for me, I went from a restaurant that had closed 88 Keys, 7 days, bought the restaurant. 6 weeks later, 24, we're open. What am I going to call the restaurant? Like, you call it Rocco's. They're going to expect Italian. Yeah, I had a couple partners. You want to call it Trio because there's three partners. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So I'm sitting in the library in Akron, and I'm sitting with a couple people, and I'm like, hey, what about Fahrenheit? And I looked at it, and they pondered. I said, you know, I know it's a science term, but I'm like, 36 degrees Fahrenheit, shit freezes, and 212 degrees Fahrenheit, water boils, pasta, and 800 degrees Fahrenheit is this, you know, a grill or a wood fire, whatever. For, you know, and it just kind of like it helped me tiptoe into not just Italian. I love Asian. I love Mediterranean. I love Greek. My wife is Russian. I love all different ethnicities of food. And Fahrenheit is just about the cooking method, the temperatures. So it gave me that honest, open look at just an empty canvas, making different ingredients, playfully curating them. Like, my restaurants are always going to have a spring roll or some sushi or some crispy rice or, you know, like something with potato nachos with fondue and crispy bacon. And, you know, that it all kind of gravitated towards different concepts in the stadiums that I do. I think I have a pretty good understanding and engineering of fine dining and venue dining and museum dining and food truck dining, because they're all different price points. I can't charge $40 for a short rib off the food truck tonight. I could charge $8 for a sandwich or a handheld, or $5 for truffle fries or tots, loaded tots with, you know. So the lanes that I navigate with my team and the youth and the Tremont that, you know, we all started with, I've just had a lot of great experiences, and the city's always had welcomed me with open arms. I'll never, ever, ever not love Tremont. I always will. There's a place in my heart for it, and I hope that it continues to thrive. I love Cleveland. It goes back to the first sentence. Homer. I'm a homer. I'm a homer. I'm a homer. I don't know if I would do this anywhere else. I love Cleveland. Charlotte, again, secondarily in the market. I love it there too, but it's still, this is home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing to think that at such a young age, you came in and you were innovative to make it happen and just took the chance, and here you are.
Right.
I think, especially hearing the story of how you came up with Fahrenheit and the way that it's a specific attention to detail, right? You know where the degrees at which things need to cook to make it the best product that it can be. It shows your care, which I think is probably what allows you to excel.
Yeah.
After receiving that first little bit of praise, like right away, Gourmet, that magazine, was talking about how you're one of the best restaurants in the country. First year open, one of the best restaurants in the company.
Yeah.
That's incredible. How were you able to stay grounded and not let it maybe get to your head or kind of fizzle out, right? Sometimes when we receive praise, I feel like we kind of ride the high horse and then maybe lose that attention to detail.
So you were based and judged on each meal at a time where cell phones weren't as popular. Your Instagram handle didn't have to be, you know, you cooking stir-fried noodles at 3 a.m. in your apartment complex, setting off the fire alarm to try to get on a food to next top chef. Cooking with intention, which is what I, you know, insulated my career around, is based on the meal-to-meal concept. You know, I'm not a huge advertiser. I'm a word of mouth. Hey, Mr. Clark comes in. Let's get him a drink. That's my advertising. First round's on me. Come on in or slip them an appetizer. That, and the formula that I always felt kept me grounded was that. Roll your sleeves up and work a food truck window. Get to know the real blue collar people around town that are at a construction site or working on the, you know, my nephew working on the steel program at the Rock Hall. I have so much different dynamic experiences under my belt. And to this day, we do the Gold Gloves. Like, think about it. I take my food truck, serve sling sandwiches and beers at the Gold Gloves. And I'm an avid boxer myself. And it's just another experience and a layer to what we do. When we talk about the word community, it's a really important word to me that I don't shortchange any one of the letters. If you have an opportunity to achieve, you know, certain things via accolades or awards or Gourmet magazine, you know, I think the best way to stay grounded is you read the good, you read the bad, digest the good, digest the bad. Yeah, then put it in a box and throw it under the bed. And you stay humble. And you learn that, like, I can't, if I bat at 1,000, every person's happy. There's never a negative review. There's never anybody going to knock one star on their Google because they didn't like their entree or didn't, you know, they didn't care for their scallops, whatever. I can't bat 1,000. I want to. Being humble, though, being grounded, having the sense to just take a step back and not react, overreact, counterreact. Just, what didn't you like? What didn't you like so much that you didn't want to tell me in person? Because you saw me. I was here. You saw me. But you wanted to wait till you got home. I would have rather reflected with you at in the moment and made it right in person. But I'm going to give us another try. I want you to come back. Hey, I'll never forget. All you got to do is June 20th, one star. I'll remember you. Trust me. But staying grounded and understanding the philosophy of making people happy and also inner, you know, laying that amongst your staff. We have a very calm kitchen most nights of the week. It gets a little crazy sometimes. But to stay and be grounded and to understand that, you know, by compassion, leadership, they're all watching you. That's exactly why, you know, I'm pleased and I'll never forget Gourmet and I'll never forget Food and Wine or Playboy or the James Beard Foundation, like Playboy. at the time, top 10 restaurants, top 10 steakhouses, whatever. But it was a big deal. And it was like, you know, Esquire, big deal. I was an Esquire for like a chef to keep your eye on 1 year. And those awards, they come, they go. You know, Cleveland now is working its way through the Michelin Guide. I don't give a fuck about the Michelin Guide. It's a tire company. I give a fuck about my customers and them having a good time. Because the guy that's flying in from, you know, Buffalo, that's a Michelin, you know, he's done all the paperwork to be a Michelin rater. I don't want him in here. I don't really need him in here. I don't really care about it. It's a tire company. But so many people would focus on it. And it's like, that's grounded to me. It's like, hey, it's cool. If we do great, we get a stroke, great. But if we don't, I'm more proud of like Gordon Ramsay was here for a week last year. The first night he was in town for dinner, he came to my place.
Heck yeah.
So like that's a, my, every one of my culinary team, guys and girls, got a picture with them, feather in their cap. It's Gordon, man. It's Gordon.
100%.
That's just as important to me as like some of the other stuff. So the accolades, staying grounded, being in the moment, staying humble, read them, digest them, put them away under the bed. They'll always be there for you to read. You'll always have that opportunity to look back and think in the moment where you were at that time. You'll never forget. With that being said, though, some clout chasers, Instagram chefs, guys, and we're active on Instagram, but I've got a team member that does it for me, and we want to give people an active look of what they're missing if they're not here. Otherwise, it shouldn't be about the 3 a.m. fire alarm going off, apartment building, just for show. You know, you don't eat food like that necessarily in my world without being grounded. So you know what I'm saying? Yeah. You're catching my wind here. And I developed that. Be humble. Do great. I never let my guys ever, or girls, ever let anybody confuse confidence for arrogance. We're just a confident group of kitchen guys and girls that are just trying to cook great food with impeccable ingredients. If you can do it at home, there's less reason for you to come out. We want you to come out so that we can do it for you. Because at home, it's, you know, you don't want to, like the cost of things right now. Staying grounded is being sharp with your pricing, because it doesn't matter. If you want a nice steak from the grocery store, it's going to probably cost you $40 for the cut of meat that you want, an 8 ounce of anything, a ribeye, a filet. Are you willing to take your chances with that $40 cut of meat, or come to me and my team and have prepared it for you for 60, 62, 65, whatever that number is? And that's how tight the margins are. Think about the labor that goes into that, the product, the butter, the sauce, the everything else, the vegetables, they get a piece of the cut too. Staying grounded is understanding that, you know, the supermarket pricing, keeping your prices in front of you, talking to your clients about pricing. There's several ways every day for you to stay grounded, just to be humble. Just embrace it. Some guys don't understand that. Some girls don't understand that. They get a little in front of themselves, and it's just like, all right, cool.
I think, Rocco, you just have a great appreciation for people and the humanity in it. Food and breaking bread and gathering around the table is such a primitive staple of human existence. And you just keep exacerbating that experience, which to me shows that appreciation for, again, the humanity in it. So if you come out here, you talk to people, if you're bringing great food, you're tapping into all these different senses of the human being, that they're going to buy into it and just be like, this is tremendous.
Sunday supper was always a big deal to my mom. And I think a lot of problems, if we took them to the dinner table on Sunday in this world, would probably be less problems if you just kind of talked about it, negotiated through it, communicated with it. It always goes back to what's on the table. I think food and memories and sharing different experiences in your life and celebrations, just as much as the celebration is just like, man, we went to Fahrenheit after that for so-and-so's graduation from this institution, and the chef was there and the food was great and it was just perfect. You remember that, and you associate and attach that to the day. And all of a sudden it's like, I've got 25 years under my belt, and I've got 25 years of graduations and 25 years of weddings. And I have people come up to me that said, you know, you did our wedding in Tremont in 2003. And I'm like, heck yeah. It was amazing, wasn't it? And they're like, it was the best meal of our lives to this day. And I'm like, that makes me so happy. Some of those dishes are still on the menu from time to time here, but we do evolve the menu and revolve toward different flavors. But like, it's an appreciation factor that I have for people, but also my wife and I we've dealt with a lot of people in a good way, in a bad way sometimes, but like in a good way. Like I've kicked people out of my place before when I was 25 years old. I didn't know what I was doing. I was trying to be Mr. Machismo. And it's like, cut through all that stuff, the red tape of that, and just like be a good human being and try to, you know, there's many more problems in this world that we all need to start solving as opposed to a good or bad restaurant experience. We just want everybody to, you know, benefit of the doubt. If there's anything I would say is eat local, spend your money wisely locally. I'm not going to tell you that you can't go to Chick-fil-A. I love it too. 10, 12 piece grilled chicken nuggets. You know, they're delicious, but try to eat local, shake hands, understand and embrace that there's a lot of people. This is a lifeline. I've got 140 employees in two states, 140 tables to put food on every night. It's a good amount of pressure for everybody, but also just that's kind of lends back towards the grounded side too. It's keeps you grounded when there's pressure on with families and stuff.
It is. That whole encompassing situation is what I think, again, I keep seeing that you excel in. And one thing about you too, Rocco, is that you're very philanthropic. You go and support different events, like Autism Speaks, you're always involved in, or your work with the food bank. I mean, you guys do a lot for different communities that are uplifting other communities around Cleveland and the greater Cleveland area. How much does that keep you grounded? And why do you value giving your time and your talents to those efforts?
So as I spoke earlier about the length of time that we've been doing it, colorectal cancer, Autism Speaks, Best Buddies, Children's Neuroblastoma, Prayers for Maria, Alex's Lemonade. Those are just a handful of things that I do throughout the years and yearly to benefit. My mother passed away from cancer in 2005. She was an exploratory patient for 3 years at UH on some, you know, studies like that, you know, like they're not necessarily, it's treatment as opposed to, you know, cures. You know, any money I can raise, any opportunities I can give, any like, hey, chef's table, dinner, people give me thousands of dollars to spend a night with me in the name of charity. To do that is a very important thing, but it's also, if you've ever sat across from a 4 or 5 year old little boy or girl that's diagnosed with cancer, it will not just impact you, it'll change your life. It will let you know that there are situations in this world that are uncontrollable. So the little part that I play with my wife and the charitable giving and the philanthropy, I mean, it's really the most beneficial thing that we can do. I can employ people. I can get all these accolades. I can be in Gourmet. I can be in Food and Wine. I can be, you know, on Fox 8 every Thursday for a decade I was. Or I can lend my talents towards raising money for cures, not just treatments. My mother was not fortunate enough to reach the cure stage of her battle, and it was treatments. So any money I can raise is always an important dollar, because here's one something like you have a, first and foremost, if I went through the room tonight in my restaurant on a Saturday night, a couple hundred people, everybody kind of knows the C word, cancer. Secondly, what if the next dollar I raise is the dollar that finds the cure? So when you start saying things like that and being grounded or staying humble, like, you know, if you sat with a young child that's got, you know, diagnosis, you'd be surprised the things you can learn from them, the engagement that you'll have with them, the opportunities to talk, the food related stuff that you can talk about. Those are the things that next dollar could be the dollar that cures, that keep those sentences going. So for me, it's really easy. And like, you know, Autism Speaks, another one. And I'm pretty knowledgeable about a lot of these. When our parents were younger, 7 foot amber waves of grain, just like the song Pledge Allegiance, you know, and then everything now has been genetically modified in the last 50 years where there's no such thing as an amber wave of 6 foot grain anymore. To you and me, it's a 3.5, 3 foot grain. That's been pushed on by lab coats so much over the years and compressed and made into something of which is more profitable and more flower, but it's caused autism in some ways, or, you know, allergies. Like 50 years ago, nobody was allergic to anything but like maybe peanuts. Yeah. Now it's seafood. Now it's tree nuts. Now it's onions. This is all based on evolution. In my heart, I believe this, but there's no other amber waves of grain. And you don't see wheat fields in the Midwest anymore because they're all owned by King Arthur or some of these big box brands, and they're all being genetically modified to be make more with less product to bottom line it. But it's genetically modifying our diets and our growth habits. And all of a sudden you have Autism Speaks. And a great friend of mine, Franklin Becker, whose son Sean has autism, he's a chef in New York, but he runs, you know, Autism Wall Street. I do it a couple of years. I don't do them every year, but I try to rotate it around because I'm a homer. I want to be in my restaurants. I also want to raise money and be philanthropic, but you could do that every weekend of the year and it could tie up a lot of time. But Autism Speaks on Wall Street, and we pair with an autism culinary student, and they're fantastic. And I reference Shane Gillis. Nobody has it better. They love life. They're excited. They're happy. They're genuine. We enjoy, we embrace. And that's just one of those autism factors that nobody really knows about. It's like to be able to raise money for those things and to be able to like jump in both feet. Those are the things that keep me going just as much as the work, the praise, the happiness with my family, the wife, the love, the lifestyle, all those things, making people happy. There's a big, big, big part of that that comes from charitable, and it all kind of comes to the package of me staying who I am, opening the door, unlocking it for you, just sitting and talking man to man for a couple hours, you know?
Yeah. I think that hearing some of those real dire situations do ground us. I mean, I think putting, like, as you're talking about sitting across from a 4, 5, 6-year-old who's been given a terrible diagnosis, you can't help but, I mean, I was like shell shocked as you're telling me this, right? You try and just put yourself in those shoes. And I think, I mean, it's innately humbling, right? Yeah. As someone who has been fortunate to not have that. And then you look at all these different blessings in your life that, not that like you can compare and contrast, because that's maybe an abrupt way of putting it, but it's almost like you're like, this is far worse of a situation that person's going through than I could.
I think too, it also reminds people, a room full of people, put everybody's problems in a hat. Would you trade your problems for some of the other folks' problems? Be in the moment, have intention, protect your peace. Those are all things that I focus on daily that try to, you know, kind of create who I am as a person, who I am for the community. And being charitable is just definitely part of it, because I have such a sword to swing when I can put people in a private room or a chef's table, or a popular one now is taking the food truck over to your house for 30 people.
That's so cool.
Rolling up for in the name of charity, feeding you, no muss, no fuss, no mess. And then we roll out, and people like that stuff. Yeah. People like to be kind of like, you know, rub elbows with me or some of the other chefs in town or some of the other restaurants in the town for that matter. And so like just having those opportunities is important. Giving back to the community is very important. Staying in the business of trying to create, you know, and establish reasons for doing it outside of just the economies of it. You know, being in a restaurant is very busy. Very tedious, very stressful. So I'd hope some of those charitable outlets ease the pain and give you a little bit of, you know, rejoice and joy.
Rocco, I would imagine that your mom left a big influence on that, on you for that, for having that type of heart. I also know it's her heavenly birthday today. So
yo,
happy birthday to her.
My mother and my brother's birthday today from here. We'll celebrate with them a little bit later. We'll celebrate with my brother a little later on. And so it is her birthday today.
That's incredible. So thanks for sharing it with me, and
of
a
course.
Special nod to her. I mean, what an incredible
lady.
Testimony.
That Rosie, man. Yeah. I got roses all the way up in my arm for her. Two colored, one red, another one red. One for my wife, Lexi, and one for my mom. Otherwise,
it's beautiful.
They're all shades of gray, man. So
that influence from her, I know, also stemmed from your culinary aspect too. Just seems like she in your life has been very influential. Again, thanks for sharing this heavenly birthday with me, because it's such a special day. And
of course,
I remember that. I would imagine that that's some day that hits you a little harder. So
sure.
With that being said, what did your mom teach you?
So I got pulled into the kitchen early. I said, obviously, we took you to the high school days, economics, home economics and baking and stuff. But early on, I was a big kid, always larger than life. My mom would tell me, always a bigger kid, heavier set. Got picked on, ridiculed, blah, 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 bus stop. My mom ended up driving me to work when I was fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And then pulled me into the kitchen, taught me how to learn, like, you know, red sauce and make some meatballs and sausage and cavatellis and fresh pasta. And my mother and my grandmother were the authors of that part of my life. And it really just kind of made me fall in love with the kitchen and the whole, again, family table, Sunday dinner, problem solved. One of the things like we practice now is like, put your cell phones away. We're here together on a Sunday, family time, boom, boom, boom. Those were the days when we didn't have those opportunities, so we couldn't capture as many moments. I do like the cell phone for that now. You can totally capture moments. But my mom and grandmother just taught me, you know, gave me a quick religious look at scratch kitchen food in the Italian realm, and I fell in love with it. And the lessons that were learned there every day, my mother, not only did she work in retail, but she worked at the church, she worked at the social center. She worked at the food banks. She did things all around town that were, you know, in the sense to help her in her own way and to help the community. So my mother gave me that just amazing example of being a community person, PSR. Again, I was in a show choir. She was the treasurer of that group. She was a part of the church. She was a part of, you know, a retail situation in on the east side. She always told me, my mother raised a hardworking gentleman and my father raised a hard worker. So double hard worker and a gentleman, and the rest is kind of history. My brother's an extremely hard worker too. And, you know, just being an impact, giving back, giving yourself the opportunity to put yourself in a position to which you can help people. My brother's a paramedic firefighter and I'm a chef. So we touch a lot of people every day. It's my mother's spirit coming through.
Yeah, right.
For sure.
What a great lady. I mean, it sounds like her involvement clearly stemmed into you too. You got your hands
on. Yeah, you go to the stadium, Rosie and Rocco's is the club levels. Her name's on a couple things in the realm of what I have. So yeah, it's a good thing. It's not a bad day. You know, it's a day to celebrate. I had a great mother. Okay. She wasn't here for a long time in my life. I got a shortchanged in some ways, but her spirit's here. I married a fantastic woman who has a lot of my mother's qualities that she doesn't think she does because she never had a chance to meet her, but it's easy. I tell her that all the time. So hug your mom, hug your dad, break bread. If you're pissed off or upset with your parents, stop it, end it, and give them a hug. It's worth it.
That's great advice right there. It really is, Rocco.
Just stop it. They're not going to change. You're not going to change who they are. Just give them a hug and force them into, let's just get over it and move on.
Yeah, you were young, right? You were only, I mean, it was
my first year of the restaurant, so it was 24, 25.
Because you said it was 05.
Yeah, yeah.
That's tough. I mean,
it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In your youth, you know, you don't expect anything like that to happen. You think your mother is this godly, you know, woman that's going to be around forever. And then, you know, we only had a handful of meals, maybe 1, 2, 5 meals together at the restaurant when it first opened. That was it. Think about all the things that we could have had since then. Mm-hmm. My mother liked to gamble a little bit. I had a place in the casino for 5 years from 12 to 17. I was in Caesar's Palace in Vegas back in the day and just didn't get a lot of those opportunities. But again, push away the feelings, get back into it with your parents, give them a hug and move on. They bought you. They created you. They made you. And they bought you. When I say that, they paid for everything. You know?
Heck yeah.
What are the stats now? It costs you X amount of dollars to get a kid from zero to completion of college.
It's got
to
be so much.
Not a number I want to talk about. Yeah. Jeez.
Rocco, you mentioned that through your parents, you were a hard worker.
Yeah.
Years ago, you were on the TV show Fat Chef.
Yep.
Right? So talk to me a little bit about this. I mean, I think it's like over 16 weeks, the show wants you to lose, what, 25% of your body weight or something?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like an outrageously expedited process.
It was 85 pounds, 16 weeks. I did it. I've maintained a majority of it. You know, I put a few pounds back on, but the unnatural side of losing 85 pounds in 16 weeks and doing it on camera and taking your shirt off for the Food Network and the million of people to watch it and see it. I learned a lot from the show. I don't regret it, but I also I don't necessarily have as much appreciation for it now as I did then. We did some crazy stuff. Like at the end when I was trying to weigh in, like I was dehydrated. My, you know, colors that were coming out of my body were dark brown, and it's just not a good ideal.
Yeah.
Like the Biggest Loser, the Fat Chef, those weight loss shows that did really well for like, what, 20 years. I haven't had a chance to go on them. I lost a bunch of weight. If there's anything I took from that, though, is I learned how to work out correctly. And I love that. And now I box a lot. I'm a multiple, you know, days a week at the gym. I box. I've got a crew of guys that, you know, close-knit individuals. I learned how to correctly, you know, gyms can be intimidating, even for a Big Chef Rocco from Fahrenheit on Top of the Mountain. I walk into the gym and I crumble because I don't know what some of the equipment is or how it works. Or there's a guy over there that could eat a Toyota Corolla. And, you know, like all that stuff weighs on me too, just like anybody else. But it taught me, you know, how to understand nutrition. If you really want to lose it and put your mind to something, you can accomplish anything you want. And then it drove home like really great repetitious workouts that gave me the correct form, because you can hurt yourself. Yeah. As you get older, you realize, you know, I was 36 when that show aired. I'm 49 now. And some of the things that I do now are based on some of the things I learned then. And great experience. I was on that show and I loved it because it was a weight loss show, but also dabbed into food, but also gave me an opportunity to say Cleveland, Ohio 100 times on camera. And I said it and I said it and I said it and I said it. And, you know, just a Clevelander, I'm proud of my city. Did Cutthroat Kitchen, did Guys Grocery Games once. I'm not a big, huge, like, game show guy anymore. Like, I don't really watch a ton of TV.
Yeah.
The Food Network, I think, is still on some of the streaming services. It's turned a lot into less knowledgeable shows or regional, like, hey, we're going to Naples, Italy today, we're making pizza, to, all right, here's a basket with squid, carrots, squid ink, kumquats, grapes, and anchovies, go. And it's like, you got to make something delicious out of that. It's like, nothing. Nah, that's just not my speed.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. But there's a skew to the chefs that are on those shows multiple times. And like, you know, Guy Fieri's a fantastic guy. I know him well. He's got great restaurants. He's also the biggest bit of business the Food Network has ever touched. He makes more in advertising dollars for them every show than any other show combined. All the other shows combined on the network don't make as much advertising revenue as the Food Network with Guy Fieri makes. So if you're looking to go on a show, awesome. I hope there's enough behind it, not just like money, or I did it because I wanted to lose the weight and I wanted to see how to lose the weight. And that's what was important to me.
That was what was curious to me, right? There's a great sense of awareness, Rocco, for you to say, I want to go on there and do this thing. It's very uncomfortable. It's a very vulnerable situation.
Sure.
Like for you to say, I'm going to go give this thing a whirl.
Why not, right?
Yeah. And to put yourself out there.
I mean, yeah. I'm not afraid of that. Like I walk pretty firm in my skin. Like I know who I am. Again, I think Cleveland has got some great people that have been, you know, discovered, and great people that haven't. At the time of my life, I was like, yeah, let's do it. Let's go on and check it out. And I know I could compete, and I know I could, definitely the Michael, who's a friend of me now and has been, he was from Chicago though. And we battled because everybody else did a good job, but they weren't like super composed like him and I were. We were both like week to week going at it. And, he ended up losing like 91. I lost 85, which is fine. It wasn't a contest, but we both learned a ton out of it. And since then I've developed, you know, I'm an American Masters boxing coach, green level. So I've got a couple more levels, but I've got some fighters that I coach in the corners at the local Gold Gloves. It's crazy. I've got the food truck outside serving sandwiches and beers, and I'm inside holding mitts for my guys, getting ready to take to the corner. You know, listen, it's not just, there's a lot to it. Like boxing is like golf, your weight, your fists, everything could be in place. And then when you get to the moment, you don't know what you just like have forgotten everything. It's like golf. You've got that, you're 110 yards out. You just had a beautiful drive to get there, and you've got an 8-iron in your hand. And you get up there and it's like, you could do everything you've done in the last 20,000 swings, but boop,
you're screaming.
Boxing's the same way. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to do this or that, until you get hit in the face and your eyes start to swell and your nose puffs up. And then you got to really understand and redirect what you're trying to do, because the emphasis is not what you were thinking about doing, because that's out of the window now. And it's only been 30 seconds and we got four 1 minute rounds. It's amateur boxing, so it's like not three minute rounds or eight three minute rounds. It's smaller rounds, but it's just like if you get popped in the face right away, it's just like you better get ready to go. So, you know, that's competitiveness to me is like, you know, I think as you get a little older and take on hobbies, find different things that you want to do, engage in a boxing gym or jujitsu or taekwondo or do something out of the box. I think it keeps you sharp and it gives you like another humble moment, another opportunity, another, like I walk into a gym, like walking to a boxing gym. I'm just, you know, there's cons on this side. There's cops on this side and some other people in the middle. I'm in the middle pack and I'm just like, let's go. I want to learn. I want to achieve. Punch me in the face. Put me in the mouth guard, you know? That's all interesting to me. And that's kind of like I do have a small bit of free time in my realm. Contrast therapy, sauna, steam, cold plunge, and then a big part of it's boxing and some physical fitness.
It's so cool to do things like you're saying that you don't typically do. It just rewires the brain and it opens those new pathways and lets yourself tap into a creative. I mean, I guess right, you tap into creativity every day, I would imagine, with your cooking. You're creating something literally from scratch to the end, which is awesome. But to do it even like outside of what you're doing every single day, I think it does. It really opens
up your eyes. Restore old cars too. Old cars and trucks.
Cool. What are you working on right now?
I'm nothing. Okay. And I do pre-1982 stuff, no computer chips. My summer driver right now, and it was a little overcast today. I didn't drive it. It was a 64 Chevy C10 truck, matte black.
So cool.
I flipped a 70 Bronco, 77 Bronco, 72 Cutlass. Nothing's in the realm right now. It's just, I don't have time, but my mechanics are all retired guys from the, you know, city municipalities, and my produce guy is kind of a venture partner in some of the cars too. So it's just a nice way to throw wrenches and tinker every once in a while.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. You know, it's one of those things where working on an old car, they don't argue with you. They don't tell you what to do, but they also can make it very difficult. So try to solve those problems, like the little mental exercises I try to do. Like some of those things are just great for the day-to-day here and keep me, you know, my head and my shoulders straight.
Doing some of those tasks to tie into a little bit what we were talking about before we even hopped on camera, that there really is like an art or an etiquette to everything. And I think that when you go in and try something new and you get popped in the face and you're like, holy cow, that hurt. Now I got to figure this thing out type of thing is how you really create some resilience and also force yourself to become disciplined in learning new tasks, new skills, and reaching new objectives. I feel like it's just necessary part of the growth and the development of who we are.
For sure. Challenge yourself. Get out there and challenge yourself. If you've never cooked an omelet, crack some eggs. Let's go. Let's get it up. What's going in your omelet? Swiss cheese, mushrooms. Let's do it. Like it's fallible to think that chefs don't make mistakes. Like I've burnt omelets. I've overcooked things. I have undercooked things. Finding your way or finding your sweet spot with things is also gratifying in so many ways. So challenge yourself by all means.
As a leader, when you experience challenges, what is your approach then to overcoming them, setting them at bay, and then advancing forward with the best path?
I always take a step back, deep breaths. I analyze the situation, filter the non-existent points that don't matter with whatever the problem is I'm trying to solve, and then start to, you know, I think a lot of problems are solved by communication. I think a lot of people, you know, their interest lies in their mind between their ears. And like whenever problems come at me, like situational stuff in the restaurant, again, step back, deep breath. Okay. There's a couple paths of which we can go. And I ultimately put it back on whoever, like, let's say a server comes to me and says, this customer is this or that or this. And then I give them a couple pathways. We can do this, but we could also do this. And then I think we could also probably do this, but this is probably going to be the one where we're going to maybe not see this customer again, sever ties, or fire them. Sometimes you have to fire customers. Sometimes customers get, you know, handsy or, you know, grippy with female, whatever. It doesn't matter what the scenario is, but sometimes. So I always try to, you know, detail and focus on the pathways to the best outcome. When I owned the casino at Jack, was the Horseshoe at the time, somebody would come in and play and lose their mortgage, whatever.
Yeah.
Take it. Take a hurting. They would come to the late night pizza shop that I owned between Corky and Lenny's and B-Spot Burgers, and they would want something for free. So the psychology behind, well, it didn't matter because they thought we were all associated with the casino. They wanted something for free. Well, that's my money and it's not free and I'm not the casino. I'm paying a big rent number to be here to service. So the psychology that you have to teach people on decision-making and how to understand different elements and different scenarios. Deep breath, take a step back. Nothing is going to be accomplished if you yell or raise your voice. Just forget it. People shut off. Nobody wants to be talked like that anymore. I grew up in a different day and age in the restaurant world where if pots and pans were flying because a hot-headed chef didn't like what I was doing, it was just necessary evil that we dealt with. People don't want to be talked like that anymore. Finding balance, being a good communicator, understanding problem. I can't solve every problem. I'm not here to tell you that, but I can give you my advice. I can tell you that we need to own it and probably solve the problem in the most unprofound way possible. And honesty is the best policy. So deep breath, step back. What's the best case scenario and how the outcome will play out?
When you're dealing with people all the time, you know it's constant, right? Like you're always facing a new adventure.
And we're sitting here now, and I've purposely left my phone in the back kitchen. It's going to have a few problems on it on a Saturday when we're done, and I'm going to solve them. And I'm going to, you know, coach through some solvable problems with some of my team. So it's development too. You got to continue. I've always been good at developing guys around me and under me and through the system. You know, I can develop my guys by sending them to Charlotte for a week and letting them see a different aspect of a city in the New South, or I can develop them here. I've got a lot of guys that have been with me for a long time. So the development aspect never really stops. Developing problem solvers is a big deal and a good thing for the restaurant community.
That's
AI is not going to take over restaurant work. I'm going to get a robot to fry my spring rolls. You're nuts. No, we're a people business. And that's kind of where it's at. It doesn't matter if that robot does it perfectly every time. I don't want people to see a robot in my kitchen. So it's not something that I'm necessarily worried about. So many businesses too are like, AI, what are we going to do? Like, I'm going to serve food. I'm going to develop my team. I'm going to make sure they're good problem solvers. That's what I think the world needs more of. The AI segment is huge. Don't get me wrong, but it's like, I'm hopeful that people still want to go out and have a good time wherever they go. So,
like, I can't even imagine a world where we don't, right?
Nah.
People don't want to come and break bread.
Right.
And have and a
if
drink
it was so great to sit at home and drink bourbon, you'd do it.
Yeah.
But it's great to come out and have a bourbon and, you know, meet somebody or share some drinks or an experience or, you know, never know. Find Mrs. Wright.
I mean, my God, look at this place too, right?
It's great, right?
My place doesn't look like this. Like, I don't know.
It's pretty cool. The chandelier is amazing. It's Italian. I'm Italian. So my wife has this great eye for style and just the fabrics and crushed velvet and everything that we do. She's amazing.
I love that. You have a great appreciation for her. I feel like you have to have just that part of that great team that you were talking about, right?
I do. Yeah, she sacrifices a lot. She is understands that the chef-driven concept, the chef-driven company that we started together. And, you know, I had restaurants prior to her, but as soon as we got married, she became my partner, not just in life, but in business. You know, the chef-driven concept takes my time sometimes. There's Sundays at 5 o'clock in the middle of a family outing where I've got to cut out and go back to work or go to work or this, that, and the other thing. You're kind of on call. But you know, when you slow down or shut the engine off, you shut it off. And I've got a great appreciation for wives or significant others of chefs. Yeah, man. Cause Karen Small, June Berry Table, she's working her butt off today too. And her significant others hanging out waiting. So
yeah.
And then he's in the same bracket. So
you never get to really be off, right? And part of being that leader is, I think you drive the boat, right? When you do roll up the sleeves and when you get in the environment, you have to make the decision. You have the final say. So it's great when you can build a team around you that is able to problem solve and make decisions on their own too. But then also when it gets past that and you are the acme, you're the guy.
Yep.
So that doesn't-
Gotta be on display too, man. I can't have a bad day. I got to have good days because my customers are expecting that. And I always usually do have a good day, but there are things and elements that take you away from those things. I just try to stay positive. Again, if you live a life of gratitude and you're grateful, the rest is kind of easy at this point. You know, for me, I'm very happy with who I am, with the company that I keep, and the surroundings and the restaurants that I've developed. There is nothing on the table for me. I'm like, I'm not going to go and open a place in Nashville or Houston. I'm pretty content just being in the cities that I'm in and enjoying kind of the fruits of our labor.
That's great. Amen. We're gonna be circling back to that in the litany in a second. It's sure. Right. Gratitude stems that first question. So you
got it.
You bit where we wanted you to chew. The kind of what, as I'm thinking about this boat analogy, you're going towards something. What do you see, Rocco, as kind of the end game for you and for Fahrenheit and your businesses?
I've got a few years left still on both. I'm in Charlotte, I think, on my lease now for another 7 or 8 years. I'm potentially in Cleveland for another 17 years here. And I've been doing it for a long time. So I don't know necessarily. For right now, though, my wife and I are on the path and trajectory of just enjoying the establishments that we have. I told you we had a concert the other night. Place was crowded, packed, boom, boom, boom. We're really interested and in love with the energy of restaurants and hospitality. Continue to do good things, be a partner to the, you know, I take my partnership seriously, whether it's with the Cavs or the Hornets or the Panthers or the Browns. And I said both cities because I like football. I'm in the stadiums. I've got great relationships with a lot of great teams. I did the Taste of the NFL, which is a national event at the Super Bowl every year. I did it for 16 years before I relinquished my duties a few years ago. And I just get a chance to put a spotlight on Cleveland, man, and just kind of get back. So I'm just excited that I still have some gas left in the tank. People still want to come and eat at our restaurants after so many years. I'm not here. I'm not the new kid on the block anymore, but I am a believer that, you know, Cleveland supports through and through. And so for the next time being, I'm going to be here just behind the stoves doing my thing and, you know, activating the rooftop. Summer's a great time in the city. We've got, you know, one of the best natural resources in the lake, 500, you know, yards away. And just really being and keeping myself in the position I'm in. I get a little older. My nights get a little earlier. I'm not in the restaurant at midnight anymore, which is not a good or bad thing. I think just you can still come and have a great meal at 11 o'clock tonight if you'd like to, or on the roof and enjoy a, you know, midnight cocktail. But I'm not here as late. I'm more into developing during the hours of which, and cut out a little 8 o'clock at night. So at 9 o'clock, again, what restaurants are fun, man. I'm sitting in the driver's seat. Like, to be honest with you, this is, people ask me a lot, like, hey chef, what would you have done? I don't know if I can ever remember thinking about anything else from that time when my mom and grandmother brought me into the kitchen, to the home economics classes, to Emerald saying pork fat rules, to going to school in Pittsburgh, to driving out to Phoenix, to living in LA and living in Vegas and opening a restaurant at 24. I can honestly say that I never really thought about doing anything else. And that's a good thing.
It is.
Because when you do find that passion, or you do find that work that really doesn't feel like a job, that's when you can really start conquering different aspects of your life. I would hope that everybody has an opportunity in their life to enjoy and embrace the feelings that I have with restaurants, and I've gotten a chance to feel at different stages of my life. At 23, when I didn't know shit about the restaurant industry, I just took a chance. To 30, to 35, when I opened in another state, to the growth that I've had, you know, along the way, and the additions and the subtractions and everything in between, going from a small bistro into two rooftop style restaurants that are 10,000 square feet each is a big, you know. And at the end of the day, I love betting on myself. Like, yeah. I love it. It's like downtown. You sure? The old John Q, Sherwin Williams. Yeah, why not? Let's go for it. I'm into that. Why not?
Yeah.
So, and Live the dream. Everybody's got one.
It's so good to hear, Rocco, that you're just going to continue being that spokesperson for Cleveland, especially while we're talking the positioning of where you are downtown. We need you here, right? We need a great restaurant that's bringing up the energy and the life, and that's so passionate about it too.
Right? Yeah, like that's really important.
Means to an end.
Public Square for forever has gotten a really bad reputation. I think it's wonderful. I think there's 20,000 people that have a public Main on Main, center of town, a casino on one side, the May Company on the other, a Marriott on the other, a Fahrenheit on the other, a Sherwin-Williams, which is a Fortune 15 or whatever it is, Fortune 50. You know, like if I can help and just revitalize a little pocket of downtown just that much more, or give you the opportunity to get off at West 3rd and come up and have a drink or nap at my place and then go to Aqua or Blue Point or Chop House or Johnny's or the Ritz or Morton's. I don't really care. I want you to hit them all. I'm not here for myself, believe it or not. I'm here for everybody. And just come downtown. Experience, you know, Thursdays in the square, 4 to 7, farmers market. They also have live entertainment on Thursday nights. So you get a kind of a double action-packed night, but check it out. Come down to the 9th Street Pier. Check out the volleyball courts. Go to the Rock Hall, albeit there's construction going on right now. Or to a concert. Or to Mocha. Or to the Chandelier. There's something for everybody to do, and there's something in the city that, you know, it's like when people come to Cleveland, it's like, well, what is it to do? Like, you know, Rock Hall of Fame, a Browns game, a Cavs game, Mocha. But there's so much more than, you know, like recently, like our wine programming in Gervaisi and some of these, you know, Eastern County wineries are killing it. And we're producing really nice dessert wines and different wines. And it's just like, we're on the same parallel as Oregon. We're on the same parallel as Burgundy, France, different parts of the world. But it's like, you'd be surprised at how people just embrace the Ohio wine programming, and whether it's Harper's Field Vineyards or some of the other smaller producers, Chiantis that they make, they're beautiful. And again, it's all about embracing locality and keeping the money in the community, you know, local wines, local ingredients. Ohio, some of the chefs in this city, in this state, were truly some of the first shake farmers' hands, go to the farmers' markets, find ingredients, procure Amish butter from Wooster, or stopping at like Grandpa's Cheese Barn up 71. I've done it several times. The locality of the community and the climate that the lake offers are branding us with some of the most beautiful relationships and ingredients, farm to table, farm to fork, and everything in between. That just really great to be an Ohio native, double O, but also just a chef in the community.
I think that's so Cleveland. It's, you want to know the source, you want to shake the farmer's hand, you want to know the chef behind the magic when you walk into a restaurant. It's supporting that small local piece. And with that being said too, I appreciate you coming on to the local podcast. I feel like that's right. Like I'm one of those trying to make the splash and do my thing too. So I appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
And having this conversation with me, Rocco. We have a closing litany that we always dive into. It's five questions. We're going to rattle them off to you.
Fire.
First one is that my contention is that people who live gratefully, which you just mentioned 3 minutes ago, is that people who live gratefully have better lives than those who do not, point blank. What role, Rocco, does gratitude play in your life?
I think it's the first thing you do when you get up in the morning and the last thing you should do at the end of your day. Grateful for what's in front of you, grateful for what's behind you, grateful for your blessings, but also I'm a prayer man. I say a prayer for all my family every night. Being in the position I'm in, having the ability to do what I do and swing people's moods into a good direction or an opportunity for them to forget about some problems or have a genuinely good experience at one of my places is probably the most riveting factor of my life that I love and I can't stop embracing. I love the sense of community when people want to come out to my place and have dinner. I want to come out on a Saturday night before a show and have a couple appetizers or rock out on a all day happy hour on the rooftop on a Sunday night, 4 to 9, all day happy hour. But it's just giving people an opportunity to have different things at different price points and Grateful is how you live, man, every day.
It creates joy.
Yeah.
It totally creates joy. It lets you live and be fully present when you recognize all the abundant blessings you have in your life.
100,000%.
Second question for you, Rocco. Do you have any regrets in your life? And if so, what have they taught you?
I think I walk daily and think about regrets often. There aren't huge ones in my life. I think earlier on in my career, though, as a younger chef, I think I could have probably been less abrasive. So I think that's a regret in some ways. And in fact, I know it. It's not just I think. It's, you know, being younger or immature or hot-headed or all the things I think that deter you. Like I said earlier in the conversation, at the point of starting to scream or yell or belittle somebody, they stop listening. They turn the switch off. Same way. I don't want anybody to feel any sort of way about what I say or how I say it. So I come from a place of gratitude, gratefulness, but also I swing a big stick. I mean, like some guys and girls in this world do. My expectations are high. So everybody that walks through the door knows that. And I want to be everything I can be to them, but also with respect to the business, the job to do, doing it well, climbing the ladder, all those things come into play.
Those setbacks along the way allow you to become who you're supposed to be anyway.
Yeah, right? I think regrets are part of what you do to make sure that they don't ever give you a reason to do it again, but also you learn from it.
So true. Yeah, I think it almost goes hand in hand with gratitude. And that's why I've positioned those questions that way, because if you look at what you've done or experienced in ways where you're like, this really I probably would have handled this differently. And you're like, okay, I have gratitude for the lesson that it taught me and wish I hadn't made people feel X, Y, or Z, but going forward, I now know that I won't, which is great.
Yep.
Third question for you, Rocco. You're in an environment that is based on events happening all around you all the time. What's on your calendar that you're looking forward to that gives you an excitement about your life?
Oh, world travel with my wife. We like to travel. We'll probably go to Europe in the late fall before we get going around Halloween, before we get going into the holiday season. So any chance I get to go, and just do some traveling or experience different culture, potentially to have some some things I can bring back here to Charlotte and just kind of embrace different things is always a great thing. So calendar markings are always reserved for travels with Lexi.
Yeah. Where are you guys going? Do you know?
Probably Europe. I kind of let her go.
Okay,
we love Italy. We love Spain. I hear Croatia's fun.
Beautiful.
Well, we're going to check it out.
Nice.
Yeah, man.
You can't beat it. You learn so much too doing that. It's like opens your eyes. And it's also beautiful, right? Like it's something different. Much what we were talking about earlier. Like,
it's really what I have to do anymore to escape for a few weeks or a few days just to get off the grid and like make it. So my wife challenges me by trying to book places where there aren't cell phone towers, which isn't a bad thing. She's pretty good at it too.
It's like, watch this.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Honey, are you getting a signal? No, we're not. Okay.
It's going to be buying one of those blockers. It's going to be in your bag. You're not even going to know it. Right. Fourth question for you, Rocco. When you lay down at night, each night, and you're reflecting on the day that you just had, what is it that you hoped to have brought to the world that specific day?
I hope along the way I made somebody happy, smile, take them out of a situation that made them unhappy, but also, you know, I'm happy to lay down with a clear conscience, knowing that I lived the best day I could today and that tomorrow's another opportunity.
Bang.
Yeah, man.
To a T, I think I could have guessed something to that effect given our conversation, your drive for just loving people.
Yeah, man.
It's amazing. My last question, Rocco.
Yeah.
I know we got to get Rock in here. What, if any, piece of advice would you offer to the audience abroad or a specific sector of the audience?
In a day and age where I think there are monetary and economies happening fast, don't replace get rich quick with hard work. Hard work has to be at the forefront of why you think the get rich quick will work. Bored Ape, crypto, all that stuff. Those, if it was easy, everybody would be walking around with pockets full of money. Back up all that with hard work first and then dabble with that and try to, you know, the get rich quick, great. If you get it done, awesome. But it's not a home run. You know, you don't know it to be come to fruition guarantee. Mm-hmm. So it's like one of those things. Hard work. It's always going to pay off in any industry.
If you strike out on that home run,
yeah.
If you don't have anything there, you have nothing to ante up again with, right? If you have that hard work at your base, you know that you can just keep pushing forward.
Exactly.
Rocco, you're awesome. I really appreciate you're such a appreciate staple you. In Cleveland here too. Everyone, if you haven't been into Fahrenheit, I don't know what you're waiting on. Again, if you're at the Browns, if you're at the Cavs games, stop into Rosie and Rocco's, get that great food. You know it's going to be amazing. Rocco's amazing. And to all of Cleveland, keep buying local, keep supporting our great city and one another in the city too. With that being said, if you haven't hit the subscribe button, I don't know what you're waiting for. We just keep delivering these top tier conversations and all of the information about the episode, including Rocco and my own socials, will be in the description below or in the pinned comment if you're on YouTube. I'm your host, Joe Clark, signing off of episode 79 of Chats with Clark. We'll see you next time.